It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, a guest makes the case for the creation of a citizen cabinet to give members of Congress more connection with the people they represent.
First, protests broke out around the world after Donald Trump signed an immigration executive order on Friday. The order bars citizens and refugees from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. That includes Syrians escaping a civil war that has left 11 million people homeless.
President Trump said the order was part of his extreme vetting plan aimed at keeping out terrorists. He also established a priority for religious minorities in evaluating refugees from Muslim countries, which would give Christians preference in the countries involved. The order has gotten criticism from world leaders, including the UN human rights chief, who called the ban mean-spirited and illegal under human rights law.
Over the weekend, airports saw stranded travelers and major protests. Here's a clip of a protest at JFK International Airport in New York. Saeed Khan joins us now. He's a lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back, Veronica.
What reasons did President Trump give and the Trump administration in general give for this executive order on immigration over the weekend?
Well, I mean, the overarching one and defense for his actions is to keep America safe and to protect it, which, of course, is certainly a noble virtue and one with which no one is going to disagree. Unfortunately, that suggests a couple of things. One, as though there was no vetting process already in place prior to his inauguration. And the other is whether or not this is really going to be directed at keeping America safe, given the fact that there really is no alignment between the countries that are targeted and any kind of terrorist attacks that happened on American shores. So those countries which would then be the more plausible target for having sent people to the country, to the United States, countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, 15 out of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were from there, the United Arab Emirates and Egypt, are not part of the focus of this executive order.
Those countries not on the list, what can you tell us about the countries that are on the list?
Well, these are seven countries. There's Iran, there's Iraq, there is Sudan, Somalia, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. Clearly, these are countries where there is an awful lot of turmoil underway. But these are also countries from where we find that because of the turmoil that is occurring, there is the greatest urgency of populations that are moving. I mean, in the case of Syria, the dislocation both internally as well as those fleeing the country is at an order of magnitude that is really unprecedented. At least 35% to 40% of Syrians are either out of the country or have been internally displaced. So that sense of exigent circumstances really warrants then what has been historically and traditionally the American role for taking people in. And again, we find that there has been a very, very stringent vetting process under the prior administration with President Obama. So this notion of trying to be even more stringent in this capacity doesn't really pass muster.
As we heard the sounds of protests this weekend across the country, and this weekend, President Trump's chief of staff, Wisconsinite Reince Priebus, spoke to Chuck Todd on Meet the Press about this. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
More have come from Saudi Arabia to kill Americans than the seven countries combined. Why was Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan and Egypt not included on this list if you are so concerned about this issue?
We are concerned about the issue, Chuck, and that's why we put the seven countries initially into the executive order that were identified previously by Congress, by both the House and the Senate, and the Obama administration as being the seven most watched countries in regard to harboring terrorists. But you bring up a good point. Perhaps other countries needed to be added to an executive order going forward.
So other countries possibly added to the executive order going forward, some countries named there, Saudi Arabia among them. Do you think this is a possibility, more countries on a growing list potentially?
There is that possibility, Veronica, because after all, we need to remember that while he was campaigning, then-candidate Trump was calling for a total Muslim ban. So whether or not this is a testing the waters for something more comprehensive remains to be seen. But on the issue of Saudi Arabia, it's interesting that Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, are not on the current list. I wouldn't really hold one's breath to see them making the list. And part of that has to do with substantial and significant commercial interests that the president has in both of those countries.
Now, you mentioned a Muslim ban, and this is something that Donald Trump, a phrase he had used on the campaign trail, he seems to be moving back from that now, saying that, that's not what we should be calling this. What do you think about how it functions and what's fair to call it?
Irrespective of what he calls it, the practical effect of this executive order and the fact that it's targeting seven Muslim-majority countries is inescapable. This is having a disproportionate impact on Muslims and on people with Muslim names. And we're finding that the ripple effect of this is actually going beyond these people from these seven countries. There are reports coming in that other Muslims, even U.S. citizens, with Muslim names are being subjected to increased and intensive scrutiny while coming back from international trips since Friday. It seems as though there may be this de jure or this by law limitation to just seven countries, but the practical impact of this is much more widespread.
We're talking right now with Saeed Khan, lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University, looking at President Trump's executive order on immigration, an immigration ban that primarily affects Muslim immigrants and refugees. And the Trump administration have said this is similar, they see it, to President Obama, what he did in 2011 when he banned visas for refugees from Iraq for 6 months. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, it's a very poor comparison in several aspects, Veronica. First of all, refugees do not come on visas. That is a fallacy right there. And again, something that apparently either the president does not understand or is particularly and purposely obfuscating. What did happen, though, was that there was a congressional act which looked at a special immigration category for Iraqi refugees. And there was a temporary freeze because the situation at the time warranted it, because there was an increase in terrorist attacks. That hasn't been the case so far. Now, regarding the seven countries as a whole, which the current administration keeps referring to, yes, President Obama did name those seven countries, but it was a very, very limited scope in how the application of immigration laws applied to them. In those cases, it simply applied to those who were dual nationals who had visited one of those countries within the last 6 months, intensifying the level of scrutiny and vetting which would then go toward those individuals. But it was clearly not a categorical ban, whether temporary or permanent.
And Saeed, it's only been a couple of days, but how has this been affecting people both in the United States and around the world who are in the process of traveling or resettling or reuniting with families?
There are cases, Veronica, where, for example, United States citizens have been traveling with family members, either spouses or children, who do not have U.S. citizenship. They might either have a lawful permanent residence or green card, or some are on a fiancé visa, or some are traveling on some other non-immigrant visa, and they're having to make a rather bitter choice. The U.S. citizen is allowed to either travel alone to the United States, leaving behind the family member, or is being told you don't have to come to the United States. You can stay with your family member who is now excluded from traveling to the U.S. So this is having an impact on splitting up families, and it's also having an impact on employees. Some individuals who were outside the country for work-related activity are now finding themselves stranded overseas, and this is now causing major companies like Google and others to issue travel warnings, and in fact is stifling international commerce and business because companies are now reluctant to send employees over even a simple border like Canada in order to conduct business.
We're talking right now with Saeed Khan from Wayne State University, and we're looking at President Trump's immigration ban that primarily affects Muslim immigrants and refugees.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's immigration executive orders? Do you think they make the country safer? Why or why not? Will you or your family or friends be directly affected by this? Do you know anyone who's having trouble going in or out of the country? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a little bit coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our conversation with Saeed Khan, lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. We're looking at President Trump's executive order that bars refugees and immigrants from seven Muslim-majority nations.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think of the president's immigration executive order. What do you make of the list of seven Muslim-majority countries? And what do you think of a potential, in effect, religious test on who can come into the country? Do you support this? Do you think it makes the country safer? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our first caller now. We have Steve joining us in Melrose. Steve, hi.
Hi. I called in earlier today and we lost connection, I guess, and I'm afraid I might lose it here. I'm pretty much in agreeance and support of the executive orders that have been put in place. And I guess the gist of it is that it's being taken way out of proportion and sensationalized, like so many things have been in the last years, by the media. And just a real point in case here with your guest speaker, Saeed, that he's saying several cases are calling in about it. Well, we need, you know, that to me is hearsay, and that's where the news reporting needs to take responsibility.
Steve, thank you for that, for calling in. And this is a pushback that has also come from the Trump administration, saying that the media has been, in a sense, hyperventilating about this and turning the story, that it hasn't been as chaotic as it may seem to be portrayed in the media, and touching on some legal aspects as well. What do you say, Saeed?
Well, I can't speak about the media because and the reporting because, quite frankly, over the weekend I kept it to a minimum. I was too occupied by answering phone calls and communicating with lawyers who are in various airports around the country for whom, yes, it is hearsay, but it is firsthand account and experience of people who are now being subjected to the consequences of the executive order. So for them, it is not sensationalization. It is actually quite real. And similarly, whether it is via social media or other means of correspondence, having firsthand knowledge of people who are in rather dire straits. Now, again, when it comes to being in agreement of this executive order for the stated purpose, yes, if it is a matter of keeping America safe, then certainly and by all means, Muslim Americans and myself are certainly in agreement and would like to promote that goal, but only if it is going to serve the purpose at hand. And again, this line of thinking suggests as though there was an absence or some incompetence on the part of the prior administration and the U.S. government when it came to vetting. For the refugees, they require 12 different U.S. agencies who vet the process and an additional 6 international agencies to go ahead and do this. The entire process takes 18 to 24 months minimum if, in fact, those individuals are successful in passing through or running through this rather difficult gauntlet. One would suggest that by the time they come through that, they have been vetted more readily and more severely than any of the people who are trying to apply for clearance in the Trump administration.
Steve, thank you for the call. And Saeed, early on you said that the reasoning behind the move, according to the Trump administration, was to keep America safe. The Washington Post is reporting that ISIS is celebrating this executive order as a victory that could act as a recruiting tool. What is that case?
Well, clearly we find then that ISIS needs very little oxygen in order to inflame the fires that it likes to do. And here what we find is that current policies are playing right into this binary of the so-called clash of civilizations model. The fact that ISIS thrives on being able to demonstrate to alienated, disenfranchised youth, both within the Middle East and outside it, to say, see, the West, for all of its values that it likes to extol of liberty, tolerance, democracy, look at how it is treating not just one segment of its own population, but in fact Muslims, which of course is something with which the ISIS recruits will have an affinity. So here it is not a matter of ISIS having to go out and do any kind of significant promotion itself. All it has to do is direct people to the executive orders or to the president's Twitter account.
Let's take another caller now. We have Sarah joining us in Green Bay. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Part of my question and my concern is we have people, you know, saying he's doing it for our security, and I can understand that. But I have a hard time creating fear in other countries and signing an executive order without crossing, you know, your T's and dotting your I's. What happens to people with visas and green cards? And we have a president who tweets, I'm doing this because there's some bad dudes out there. We sound stupid. We sound absolutely stupid. And it's making ISIS seem smart. And we should be embarrassed. Absolutely. We need to make sure people are coming in. But I know someone who has a home in New York, and she couldn't get back. She has dogs and a job and a purpose, and she can't get back because there's bad dudes out there. At the end of the day, we have to be protective of our country, but we have to be smart. And who is advising you?
Sarah, thank you. A bunch of points there that Sarah brought up. Getting at education and information about the executive order, how it be implemented, was there time taken for coalition building, and how will it affect just sort of the flow of air travel and the way people can move freely across the country and the world. Saeed, you want to take a swing at some of those?
Sure, why not, Veronica? Well, first of all, and thank you for the question, Sarah. The main thing to see here and upon which we rely is a certain flow of process, a certain efficiency, a certain organization. And what is now emerging from these executive orders is that there was no consultation with those who are actually the professionals within Washington. Now, whether that is severe paranoia, mistrust for Washington because the president sees himself as the consummate outsider still is to be seen. But the fact that these executive orders were not vetted by anybody within the Department of State, the Department of Homeland Security, is a rather troublesome development, and particularly when it's dealing with the constitutionality of people's basic rights. That is cause for an awful lot of concern. And unfortunately, it is something which is leading to a tremendous level of mockery, not just among our adversaries like ISIS, but also amongst our allies. 2 weeks ago, I was actually on an overseas trip, which took me to Doha in Qatar, Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, and also to London, England. And the one common denominator in all three of these areas were people just mystified at what direction was happening and how America was taking this turn for something that they didn't see as very productive. Now, the other issue regarding education and those people who are here who are now being left outside the country, this is not just women and children who, again, it's very difficult to make the case that they pose a threat to national security, but also doctors at the Cleveland Clinic and at Johns Hopkins, people working for Silicon Valley, are being now excluded from returning to the country. People coming to the United States who had already received visas to enter PhD programs in places like the University of Michigan's Engineering School, they are being left out. So the fact that this is now so totalistic and is affecting so many different sectors of society and on an international level by just simply the stroke of the pen is quite remarkable.
Inside, Sarah ended with the question, who's advising him, and I'm President Trump in this case. What do you say to that? We heard news over the weekend that chief political strategist Steve Bannon had been brought on to the NSC's main committee. Maybe some of the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff taking a lesser role. What do we know about that advisory capacity right now?
It's quite telling, Veronica, about exactly who's going to be the brain trust in this White House, which not just individuals, but entire departments and institutions within the government apparatus are going to be willingly and knowingly circumvented. That should be a cause for concern of a lot of people. I mean, the government operates with certain safeguards, certain checks and balances, which are implicit within that. And it seems as though there's a very conscious effort to go ahead and move around those individuals as well as the apparatuses themselves. It seems as though, from all accounts, that Steve Bannon's fingerprints are all over these executive orders. And it seems as though this is particularly troublesome given his broader worldview when it comes to not just refugees, not just immigrants with the fear of terrorism, but immigrants to American nativism. It seems as though this is just the beginning of a longer trajectory of policy objectives, including the limitation of H-1B and other non-immigrant specialized work visas, which is, of course, going to have a major impact on Silicon Valley, the medical field, and elsewhere.
And Saeed, we're just about out of time, maybe 20 seconds left. You've got a phone ringing, but legally, what do you expect to happen next?
Well, the fortunate thing is that almost immediately we have the ACLU and other organizations who have taken the ball and run with it. We find, in fact, it was their swift work which caused now four federal judges to declare the executive order and the deportation proceedings or the exclusion proceedings to be unconstitutional. The problem, though, is that the Customs and Border Protection, there are accounts that many of them are openly defying the court order. So what we're going to find then is a battle between the executive branch and the judicial branch. So stay tuned.
Saeed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Saeed Khan from Wayne State University talking about President Trump's recent executive order banning refugees and immigrants from seven Muslim-majority countries.
After the news, we'll hear about an effort to give citizens more of a voice with their elected officials. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll hear from a Wisconsin guest who attended last Friday's annual rally against abortion in Washington, D.C. She'll talk about the Wisconsin presence at the event and the future of the anti-abortion movement here and beyond.
First, in some ways, 2016 was the year of anti-establishment politics in the United States, especially in the presidential elections. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders sustained an unexpectedly strong campaign against Hillary Clinton. On the Republican side, anti-establishment feeling helped Donald Trump defeat a big field of opponents on his way to his Electoral College victory in November.
But what's behind voter discontent with the status quo? In a survey released in November by the group Voice of the People, a strong majority said that the federal government serves a few big interests more than it serves the people, and that big donors and political parties have more sway than everyday voters.
Our next guest is hoping to bridge this perceived gap between the American public and elected officials, in part by creating a citizens' cabinet in each congressional district to bring people together with their representatives. Stephen Kull joins us now. He's founder and president of Voice of the People. He's a political psychologist and director of the Program for Public Consultation at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I mentioned that survey you put out there, a major bipartisan agreement that people felt like their voices weren't being heard by the federal government. Can you share some of your findings?
Yeah, it's really an overwhelming result. For example, we asked the question, would you say the government is pretty much run by a few big interests looking out for themselves, or that it is run for the benefit of all the people? More than 90% said that it is run by a few big interests looking out for themselves, and this was very bipartisan, overwhelming majorities of both Republicans and Democrats. And while this view has been back in the 60s, only a minority of people had this view. It's been on the rise, and for a while now has been 8 and 10, but this time we did it, it jumped above 90% for the first time.
And was this part of the appeal of Bernie Sanders and especially Donald Trump?
Very much. Both of them spoke to this concern. The theme that government ignores the people, and both of them basically said, I am going to listen to you. And this was reiterated in Trump's inaugural speech, where he said that the power in Washington is going to be given back to the people. This is the day that the people became the rulers of this nation again. He was making these statements throughout. His pitch went, you think that government is for sale, that rich people can buy politicians, corporations can buy politicians. Well, you're right. I know. I've been doing it for years. But you see, now I'm so rich, nobody can buy me. And that was a very effective pitch to the people. And it wasn't. We found by in this study that we did, what was driving Trump supporters wasn't so much anything about his ideological positions, but the sense that he was different, that he was actually independent of the political system, and the fact that he was criticized by elites on both sides of the liberal and conservative, Republican and Democrat. He just pointed that and said, see, this is proof that I'm independent of the system, so you can take a chance with me and try something new.
Are we getting to a point where, with these doubts about who is being represented, that people are questioning the legitimacy of our form of representative government, maybe of the idea of representative government?
The idea of democracy is still as strong as ever. The people feel like there's the principle that the will of the people should govern, and the process of elections and all that is truly supported throughout the country. There's really no counter view on that. But the perception is that the system has really been effectively corrupted, and that elected officials do not listen to the people. They are not influenced by the people. They're influenced by special interests, by the wealthy, by campaign donors, and by the political parties working for their interests rather than the interests of the people. And that, yes, that puts the legitimacy of the system at risk, you might say. There's a kind of social contract that people learn as children, that government, you in a sense give the power to the government, but the government makes a commitment to represent the people and serve the common good of the people and to be responsive to the people's will. And the perception is that this is not what is happening, and this is the source of anger at the government, and is something that Trump is effectively able to capitalize on.
Talking to Steve Call from the group Voice of the People. And Steve, one of the ways you've been working to try to bridge that gap is with the idea you've been promoting, a citizens' cabinet. Tell us how this would work. One in each congressional district, right?
Right. Well, the idea is that to give the people a greater voice. Now, a lot of the decisions that government makes are the people. I mean, you can do polls, and that can be helpful, but there are a lot of issues where people don't have enough information. And sometimes when you use standard polls, you can say, well, do you want to reduce the deficit? Yeah, that'd be good. Do you want to raise taxes? Do I want to raise taxes? Oh, I'd rather not. Do you want to cut spending in these areas? Oh, I'd rather not. And all of those are rational and consistent. In understandable positions, but when they're all added up, politicians can go, oh, well, the people are just a big baby. They can't cope with these complex issues. So we have developed a method that we call a policymaking simulation, where we take people through a process that tries to put them in the shoes of a policymaker. So they get a briefing on the issue, they're presented policy options, they hear pro and con arguments on the issue, and then ultimately they make their recommendations. And often they do it in a way where they have to deal with trade-offs, like going back to what I was saying about the budget. They say, okay, here's how we're spending the money. Here are the sources of revenues. Everything's broken out in some detail. And up here is the deficit. And this is done online with a representative sample. And then people propose their budget, but they're getting feedback as they go along on the impact on the deficit. And in that context, actually, people cut the deficit quite a lot. The majority cut it a few hundred billion dollars. So people are able to deal with these issues and give meaningful input. We did one on Social Security recently, and three-quarters of Republicans and Democrats agreed on steps to eliminate most of the Social Security shortfall. That's the amount of money that the Social Security system needs to keep giving out the benefits at the current levels.
So you're doing these simulations online now, but you're hoping to formalize this a little bit more with this citizens' cabinet idea, right? How would you pull those people together?
Right. Thanks for prompting me along there. The idea then is to get a representative sample in every congressional district and state who will go through these policymaking simulations and give members of Congress, their elected officials, input, recommendations about what they should do on the important issues that they're facing. And if we were to have that fully built out, there would be over 100,000 people nationwide going through these processes. Now, we've gotten started doing it. It's a kind of demonstration project, hoping that it will grow. And we've done these policymaking simulation surveys with about 8,000 people and with samples of over 400 in 8 major states. What's really striking is how much consensus there is between the really conservative and really liberal states. They do come to a lot of very similar conclusions, and they do solve a lot of key problems.
Right, yeah. I would think that if I went out and randomly selected a bunch of people, I'd have some people really on one extreme, one on another extreme. There wouldn't be a lot of agreement. What is it about this process that lets people maybe set aside some of those partisan assumptions and agree on some stuff?
Well, it turns out when people reason things through and they see the trade-offs, most Americans don't want to simply choose one side or the other. If you plot Americans on a left-right spectrum, you don't have a bunch on the left and a bunch on the right. You have more of a normal curve where there's much more of a clustering around the middle, and people say, you know, I want to find the right balance between the values of the left and the right. And we try to give them the tools so that they can find what they think is the right balance. And when they do, it turns out that people end up in a pretty similar range. They're not exactly the same, but there's a lot of common ground appears. And one of the things they really don't like about the way Congress works, it's, well, okay, which side are you on? Okay. Sign up, volunteer, send us your money, and we'll fight for that side against the other side, right? And that really turns off a lot of people because they think that Congress should be more of a problem-solving body, and they should look for ways to integrate the values that are expressed on both sides. And turns out when you get average people, there are some people who are quite ideological and tend more toward the polar ends of the and find less common ground. But that's not the bulk of the people. The bulk of the people actually do find consensus.
We're talking to Stephen Kull, founder and president of the group Voice of the People, looking at a disconnect between the American public and their elected officials. He wants a citizens' cabinet, a cross-section of people in each district to provide advice after they get some information on key issues, and they'd give that info to members of Congress.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think elected officials place their parties or their donors ahead of the public good? Do you think they need to hear more from the public? And what do you think of our guest's idea of a citizens' cabinet? Have you worked in government at any level? What worked and what didn't when it came to getting public input? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing the conversation with Steve Cull from the group Voice of the People. He says there's a communication gap between the American people and their elected officials in Congress. He's hoping to bridge that gap, in part by creating a citizens' cabinet in each congressional district.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you feel like the federal government is hearing your voice? Do you think your representative in Congress does? Do you think that Congress is too polarized? And what do you think of this idea of a citizen cabinet? Do you like it? Do you have questions about how it might work? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Doug is with us in Three Lakes. Doug, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm listening to this issue and I'm thinking, why not just get rid of the lobbyists in our government? That would be one huge step for the people in general, and it would take out, it would eliminate all of the strong arm lobbying because of there's huge money involved in all that.
Doug, thanks a lot for that call. And going back to your survey, Stephen, a lot of people, it sounds like, might agree with Doug about frustration with the access given to lobbyists as opposed to everybody else.
Yeah, lobbyists are viewed very negatively by the American public, and they are perceived as having a lot of influence, and they are the instrument through which corporations and wealthy people do try to influence Congress. Now, we can't, because it would be a violation of freedom of speech, we can't just prevent that kind of communication from happening. What we can do is essentially create a kind of lobby for the people to give the people greater voice, and that's really what the voice of the people is trying to do. And you can participate in that as well. If any of you, your listeners out here want to try the process, it's not limited to the people who are part of the citizen cabinet. Any citizen can go online, go through the policymaking simulation, and then ultimately make your recommendations and send them off to your member of Congress. If you just go to VOP.org and click the button that says policymaking simulations, you can communicate and effectively become part of the people's lobby, saying what the people think should be done.
And we've got a link to the Voice of the People website on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now with Ken in Beloit. Ken, hi.
How you doing, guys? You know, I just wanted to make a comment, especially in our state of Wisconsin. It seems like our GOP leaders, they surround themselves with only their base of donors and base of people. They don't listen to the general population of people, you know, and I use Paul Ryan and Ron Johnson as examples. You know, when they campaigned around our area, the venues they went to were by invite only. It was their specific, group of donors that they surround themselves with and who they speak to. You know, you can see them guys in the union halls and at the libraries, like the. I mean, I'm not gonna say they won, so they must have done something right. But when they surround themselves by only the people who agree with them, it appears that they're extremely disconnected. You know, Paul Ryan hasn't carried Janesville in years.
Ken, thanks for the call. So Ken saying, Steve, that politicians willing to surround themselves with a bubble of people who mostly agree with them.
Yeah, that's what happens, and they spend a huge amount of their time fundraising, and it isn't just the money that they get; it's just that those are the people they hear from, because that's how they're spending their time. So the idea of having a citizen cabinet is that people they would be systematically presenting the views of the people. You think, well, if they just wanted to, they could know what people think. And we've done research on this, and done surveys of congressional staffers on what they think the people in their district would say in response to certain poll questions and things like that. And they're very bad at predicting correctly what their constituents have to say. So the systems in place for communication between the people and elected officials are very poor, and so that's the gap we're trying to fill here.
But if a politician does go out into possibly hostile territory or a non-controlled environment, there's the risk of, you know, a lot of protest and maybe shouting matches that for better or worse, don't give a really productive conversational environment to exchange views. Is that That's part right. of what you're trying to get around with the citizen cabinet?
Yeah, and many of those cases, too. Like, there are a lot of town hall meetings where people come who are usually at the extremes. And they yell, and they yell at each other, and when you go to one of those town hall meetings, you get this impression of the public as being very polarized. But I regularly do focus groups with a small representative sample of citizens, and that it's not like that at all. The people have some differences, but they try to find common ground, and they often generally do find common ground. The more they talk, so the answer isn't necessarily to create situations where people can you know yell at each other, but to create situations where people are given enough facts, where they hear both sides of the issue. And something very interesting too to mention on this: when we present the pro and the con arguments on issues, you know, these are very strongly stated pro and con arguments that have been vetted with congressional staffers from both parties. Well, in most cases, the majority finds both sides convincing, at least somewhat convincing. So it's like people going, oh, yeah, that's a good point. Oh, yeah, that's a good point, too. And we think that's actually a good thing, because they're actually thinking, they're deliberating. That is the typical person, not this highly intense arguer, flamethrower. And those people right now feel really kind of alienated from the political system, and we're trying to create a way for them to reason and express their point of view, just like the founder said should happen. That's the reason of the people that should govern, not their passions, not their misinformation, but the conclusions they come to when they're informed and have a chance to think it through.
Ken, thanks for that call. We're talking to Steve Call from the group Voice of the People, trying to get more communication between citizens and their elected officials. So, Steve, you've got people talking. You've got these online policy sims going with randomly selected people. Are people in the nation's capital listening? Do you know if members of Congress or their staff are starting to pay attention to what you're getting from people?
Yeah, they do. We meet with staffers and give them briefings. We give briefings on the Hill and have pretty good turnouts of staffers that come. You know, all of these things take time to work their way through. The more people step forward and say, you know, listen to the people and who, you know, on their own go through the simulations, the better it is. And I think at this point, there is members of Congress are starting to, you know, with the success of both Sanders and Trump, they're starting to scratch their head and think, wow, maybe what is it that we're doing wrong? Why are people so dissatisfied? And maybe we need to respond in some ways. But they also have patterns that are difficult to break. They still tend to think that they need to take money from raise all this money from donors, and then that tends to influence them. So, but at least there's a voice there. And what's interesting to me is that wherever I went on the Hill, whether we're talking to people on the left or the right, Republicans, Democrats, what we heard over and over goes, yeah, that's right. This is really how we ought to be doing it. So they are receptive. They do want to hear. But at the same time, it takes time for old patterns to be broken.
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Stephen Kull. He's founder and president of the group Voice of the People. He's also director of the Program for Public Consultation at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. Well, you can play the home edition of Voice of the People. You can go online to their website. We've got a link at the Central Time Facebook page. Find those policy sims that Steve was talking about. They've got a bunch of them up there on various issues, and you can go through the process that he's been talking about. Get information, basic facts about an issue, arguments from both sides, maybe more than two sides on some of those issues, and then think about it. Think about the trade-offs and what kind of decisions you might make. Share your thoughts about this idea and find a link to the Voice of the People website. You can do it all over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Back in November, we had a Food Friday conversation about soup with the author of the book Soup Swap. And Rob, you and I both put this into action this weekend.
That's right. I've been on a soup tear over the last few months. Just about every weekend now, I'm making some kind of soup. And this weekend, I tried my hand at a lentil soup that I think came out pretty good. You may have smelled it as I was eating it for lunch.
Didn't smell it, but I'm sure it was delightful.
So what did you make?
I made carrot ginger soup, actually. And it's a recipe that I got from another WPR staffer, Anne Strainchamps, actually, from To the Best of Our Knowledge.
I know her.
She passed it along, and yeah, it's got a lot of ginger in it, a lot of carrots, and we're going to eat it tonight. It's going to be yummy.
You know, I just realized what was holding me back from making soup a lot for a while is the kids. They don't like soup.
I was just going to say that. My kids don't like soup either.
And I finally said, the heck with it. I like soup. My wife likes soup. We'll both eat it. So whatever. The kids miss out, and they'll observe their parents eating healthy soups and maybe absorb some lesson for the future. I don't know.
So this is not good. Your children are older than mine, so they still don't like soup when they're about 3 or 4 years older.
It's the new. It's like the millennials and their breakfast cereal. Now it's the younger generation and their soup.
Man.
It'll just be like instant. It'll be Jetson's food pills before long.
I know.
Mark my words.
What's wrong with the youth of today?
The youth are great. We love them. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.